I think the Congress would be facing this from a budget perspective and sort of seeing it eat the budget and one way or the other. I think you are correct that often the device that the average congressman can understand and describe is the A trust fund.
That's
but I think
saying.
They act on the whole
I
problem.
Agree that.
And so I do agree with you, but just a little distinction.
The second question I wanted to ask was, you know, part of the debate in Congress, listening to friends and former colleagues on the Hill, there was a big debate about beneficiaries versus providers. And whether 50% of it should be beneficiaries, 50% should be providers, or there should be some other mix in terms of cuts and who gets hit. And it didn't strike me as the right way to think about things. First of all, we know on the one hand, and Chip's sitting here and everyone keeps referring to Chip, so I'll do the same. you know, providers are you know, facing a lot of challenges in the healthcare environment. And the ACA put a lot on their shoulders. On the other hand, you know, you look at MedPAC's report, we've got a long way to go in certain areas. So, and then, you know, I want to be sensitive to Rick's point about the sustainability of some of the cuts. So, so on the one hand, you've got the providers, which is sort of a mixed bag and clearly more places for Congress to go. But on the other hand, the beneficiaries, and I think this is why the administration looked at the higher income beneficiaries, there are a lot of people living on just their Social Security income and thinking about transferring it and shifting a lot of cost on the beneficiaries just seemed like a short-sighted way to go, and you'd have even greater problems in the long run. So, you know, I don't know that this is really a question so much as a comment that, you know, I think that the Congress hasn't been thinking about solvency, number one, in the right way, and number two, the solutions they're looking at. It's sort of an either-or approach or some combination of the above, but doesn't really get at fixing some of the underlying fundamental structure of Medicare and some of the problems facing the program. And I don't know if you've thought about it as beneficiaries versus providers, but that does seem to be how Congress is looking at some of the trade-offs.
Well, I think that's right, and you know, you have to remember that providers are people too.
You okay there, Chip?
All right. But I think the you know, obviously you know the baseline or the default position of Congress is to prefer is all other things being equal, they prefer to somehow reduce spending going directly to providers and try to maintain the argument that that's not going to affect beneficiaries, rather than do something that explicitly affects a beneficiary, like raising the cost of something. That's the natural inclination. And it's pretty understandable. There's nothing novel about saying that. I mean, that is going to be the tendency. And I think the issue now is whether the debate may have gone slightly beyond that point, so that pressures on providers, that ordinary Americans do perceive that as actually affecting them in a very direct way, such as lack of access to doctors and so on. I think the other issue you raised about high-earning seniors and so on is very valid, and I support that. I think that if we're going to have a program and we're going to be concerned about budgetary issues, and somebody's going to get less, quite frankly, the person who's got the most money should get less. I mean, I think if you want to have an efficient program, that I think conservatives and liberals should be able to agree on this. So I think that's an element, but that's a distribution of who pays. It doesn't affect the bigger economic kind of impact of healthcare and the Medicare program, and that's the structural changes that we're all wrestling with that are the key, I think, for the long term.
I would add, Liz, that in terms of beneficiaries, you can't do a whole lot about the benefit formula, the benefit structure for beneficiaries. It's sort of cheap to begin with. You can make the changes that Mark talked about that would make a lot of sense. But in terms of scaling back benefits, that's hard to do because there's not that much there. You can make beneficiaries pay more, either while they're working or as beneficiaries, and a lot of that's already been done. And in terms of providers, we're in the middle of this big experiment now. To what extent can we scale back provider payment rates? Now, we pay a lot for healthcare services in the U.S. compared to other countries. Changing that would unleash a lot of dynamics that might not be very pretty, but it could be done. But there's something else that you didn't mention that we have to talk about, and that is In many respects, Medicare is no different from Medicaid or private health insurance or people paying out of their own pockets, in the sense that if you look at the drivers of health care, and the best studies out there are the ones that Joe Newhouse and David Cutler did, and your latest one, Sheila Smith and Mark Freeland. But they focus on the impact of medical technology, which affects everybody across the board, as well as excess medical prices, which you may or may not be able to do much about. But I'm convinced you cannot do something meaningful about the long-range healthcare cost growth situation without addressing the issue of new technology, and at least adopting it more prudently. And beyond that, you can go a long way. The question is, how badly do we as a nation want that new technology that's valuable and worth it, and how much are we willing to pay for it? And that's a trade-off that nobody has an answer to.
Opening it up for questions, Ron, and please identify yourself and your organization.
Sure, thanks. It's Ron Pollack, Families USA. A number of you, I'm building on Liz's your comment about what burden we place on beneficiaries, and I haven't heard the term used, but it's a discussion really about having skin in the game and what that might do with respect to costs. And a couple of the proposals, whether it's putting some limits on first dollar coverage or premium support, I don't think there's anything even from a consumer perspective that in and of itself is troublesome. However, I think Stuart demonstrated, as he usually does, sensitivity about who pays and who doesn't pay. Mark, in your presentation, you talked about special protections for the poor. So I want to raise this one concern, and that is, as you do increase potential out-of-pocket costs for beneficiaries, it really is important to provide protections for lower-income beneficiaries. And the concern I want to raise is that even when you structure some special subsidies or some special help for lower-income beneficiaries, it often doesn't really reach them. I mean, we have a history here of Medicare savings programs, all these different initial programs, QMB, SlimBs, QI1s, and the reality is that an inadequate percentage of those who are eligible actually get enrolled in this. And so I guess the comment I'd like to make, and happy to have you respond to, is that if we're going to provide some mean sensitivity so that we protect those people who can't afford this greater burden, we have to actually have to have enrollment systems in place that's actually going to make sure, not just on paper, that they're eligible, but they actually get that protection. I mean, we'll probably see a bit of this with the Affordable Care Act for the general population as we move to premium support. And it's unclear how many people will get enrolled in the tax credit premium subsidy. But we have a rich history with respect to Medicare, and it isn't a great history. And so we've got to have some automatic mechanisms to make sure that that special protection actually gets delivered.
I mean, I of course completely agree with that, and I think it does get you to, as you know, I mean, you look at ideas like the automatic enrollment sort of idea, so you're presumed enrolled. You look at the difference in enrollment rates between Medicare Part B and Medicaid. You know, one you're presumed to be in unless you sign all the forms to say no. The other you've got to sort of somehow figure out how to enroll in the first place. So I think you're absolutely right that part of what we've got to do is do exactly what you say, to find more effective ways of having people in some way automatically enrolled that are eligible for these things. I think the skin in the game issue is a kind of an interesting issue, because if I read Gene Sterling's piece outside correctly, Gene, and you can speak for yourself, thinks that some of these moves towards employers putting more financial requirements on the employees is really the consequence of some of the sort of the pressures on employers and the cost, rather than something that's triggering this, being a factor in triggering the cost reduction. Or at least, from what we think is going to be a long-term cost reduction. Others take a different view. So I think this whole issue of what, how much skin in the game, how it actually works, is an uncertain science. I think it is part of what we've got to do. I think it's the right way to go, but I'd be the first to admit that we don't quite know where to put that yet, and how much is going to actually work. But I think the key is, as others have said, that there's a huge difference between something which is a one-time or short-term saving, changing something in that way, and something that triggers a change in the dynamic that is constantly revisiting costs. I think competition is very different from, say, a one-time breakthrough in an organization of, say, ACOs or something like that. And I think the more we look at this, we've got to look at mechanisms that not only have one-time savings, whether it be changes in how much somebody pays, and change in their premiums, but something that triggers a change in the dynamic so that you've got a constant searching for better value in some way. If you don't do that, I think it's very hard to imagine how you're going to see a long-term kind of slowdown in healthcare costs. I just don't think logically it works.
Does anyone else want to comment?
Yeah, Ron, let me just mention also, your point's well taken about the relative ineffectiveness of certain programs that are out there. Like only, what, about a fourth of people who qualify for SLMB under Medicaid actually get it. But keep in mind, with the startup of the exchanges, or I guess we're supposed to call them the marketplace now, but with the exchanges, people will go in not really knowing what they might be eligible for, and the exchanges will help them figure that out, including Medicaid eligibility. And the enrollment process will be greatly simplified, no asset test, et cetera, et cetera. So all that will make a difference.
And the things I would say on both these points, I too see your point and agree with you. And I think in thinking about the benefit redesign, if it creates issues for the poor and the near poor, I think, you know, the first step is target the solutions to them, because often the reaction to this kind of thing when I'm in different rooms is you can't take Medigap away from anybody. What are you going to do about the poor? And that's an incredibly inefficient way to help the poor. And so make it MSP, and then I think your comments start to apply. And you can think of leveling up with the LIS and Part D and having enrollment made when the person applies for Social Security. Try and get at some of the things that you were going to say, or that you were saying. The one last thing I just want to get on the table on competition, and maybe you'll respond to it. You know, we are, like I said, in the June report, we're going to have a discussion of design issues on these kind of incentives for beneficiaries and the premium support-like comment, because there's a lot of complicated issues. And one of the issues that's hanging out there is consolidation in the marketplaces. We're sort of assuming there is competition in these marketplaces, and lots of these markets are not really that competitive. And so that, you know, if we went to private, in Rick's chart, private sector prices in hospitals tomorrow, overnight, we're talking about a 30% increase in hospital costs for Medicare. I mean, it's a huge issue, and I'm not quite sure how to navigate it.
I just want to point out that there was agreement between Ron Pollack and Stuart Butler on the need to protect low income beneficiaries. We'll go to the next picture. I just wanted to capture that and mark this date. Next question. Yeah.
Peggy O'Kane, NCQA. I'd like to know how you define productivity, Rick, because I think that in that there may be some ability to unlock real productivity, which to me is kind of that amount of health you get for your healthcare dollar. And the RVU system, as we look at it, I don't think we're going to have everybody capitated, but in the part of the system that's paid on fee for service, I was just at a conference on physician compensation, and it's amazing how much that drives behavior. You know, there's benchmarks for it and so forth, and there's tremendous pressure on doctors to up the RVUs. And there's all kinds of new opportunities to be more efficient in the system today with better communications tools, patient engagement tools, and so forth, that people are not paying attention to because they lose money in the fee-for-service world. So I wonder if you could answer that basic question, and then I'd love to hear from the panel on that sort of concept.
Sure. Let me start off by saying that I so much hope that David Cutler one of these years wins the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work in outcomes-based health productivity measurement and health value measurement, as well as the whole idea of outcomes